You're doing the intro, so you count us in.
All right. In 3, 2... Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
We, in fact, have an expert with us today. We have the most expert of experts.
The most expertest of experts?
Yes. In fact, we've been talking him up quite a bit this week. So we are delighted to introduce the one, the only, the genius, Matt Piscatella, who is a video game analyst at NPD Group.
Well, wow, that's nice. Hey, am I supposed to use, like, my NPR voice, or how does this...
No.
No, we want you to use your Matt voice.
I like your Matt voice.
Hey!
What's going on?
Hey, everybody! Thanks for tuning into the podcast today. I just want to tell you about...
You are absolutely not doing this bit on our podcast. I will edit it out. Bad boy.
I'll explain the bit to anybody who wants to DM me.
Boo.
Or at me later.
At him and call him names. Yeah. That's what I would do.
So we're huge fans of yours, Matt. I don't think we've made any secret of that. Matt has been a friend, has been a regular source for stories that we've written back when Amanda was editor-in-chief of Game Daily and I was writing for her. If there's someone I look to help me break down the numbers and help me understand what's going on, it's Matt. So, Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about the kind of work that you do and your background?
Well, right on. Well, first, the admiration is mutual, and thanks so much for having me on. This is really cool. So I work with the NPD Group, which is a multinational research firm. We track nearly $2 trillion in consumer spending in the U.S. across a number of categories, including video games. I am the U.S. video game industry analyst, and my job is to help translate what we're seeing in the data for our retail, publishing, and development partners to try to really understand the big trends in the market, where things are going, and what's going on out there.
So I just want to make sure that I heard that correctly. That was $2 trillion with a T, correct?
Yeah, and video games is just a very small portion of that, but it's a fun one. And I get to do that instead of like looking at auto parts or stuff like that. Like, I think I have one of the better gigs.
I think so, too.
You have an excellent gig, especially compared to, we'll call him Joe Bob, who covers auto parts.
I don't know. He's really into auto parts, so maybe he's actually liking his gig. I don't know.
Does like, he have a nickname like Sparky?
Yeah, he's really into it. Like Brake Pat? I don't know. But yeah, I really like games. I've been around the games business for over 15 years. I was at Activision Blizzard way back in the day. I was there with the launch of Call of Duty, the Xbox, or Call of Duty 2, Guitar Hero, Tony Hawk, and all that. And at Warner Brothers Games, I was the vice president of sales planning there. For a long time, and I've been doing this for about 3 years.
That's awesome. You know your stuff. And this is a statement. That's not a question. That is a statement. You, in fact, know your stuff, sir.
Well, that's cool. Thanks, man.
It is my pleasure. So we have a number of questions that we put together about obviously some weird stuff that's going on in the market. In fact, the episode we have decided to call this one episode, this is episode 3, right?
Yes.
Say Thursday?
Yes.
Episode 3. The title of the show is Disruption?
Question mark?
Question mark? Let's put a question mark on that.
I think I'm going to put a question mark on it. It's going to have an ellipsis and a question mark.
That's good. I like that. So this week is actually, despite everything that's going on, this was supposed to be GDC week. We just received news that GDC has been rescheduled for GDC Summer at the Moscone Center in San Francisco.
I don't even know how they managed that. That's impressive.
It's impressive. It's going to be August 4th through 6th, assuming we're not all still social distancing. And quite frankly, I'm not convinced that we're not still going to be social distancing at that point. But good on them for giving it the good college try.
The
old college try there.
Wow.
So this week we saw, because it was supposed to be GDC week, we saw that Microsoft and Sony both released specs for the Xbox Series X.
Oh, I'm sorry. You mean when Mark Cerny decided that he was going to become tech nerd ASMR.
Yes.
In an afternoon. God, it was amazing.
Mark Cerny. Today we're going to be talking about the PlayStation 5. Crinkle, 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 crinkle.
It was perfect.
Did you watch that, Matt?
I did. Yeah, it was I think it was very impressive.
It was highly technical.
I mean, I will tell you, like, I would rather watch Mark Cerny than anybody else, quite frankly.
Deliver that kind of talk. Yeah.
Anything over it. Very relaxing, very soothing. You know, I've been in games a long time. I understood some of it. So that was good.
Yeah, it was impressive. I will tell you that the one thing that freaked me out just a little bit for a couple of reasons was the fake people. That they did that in...
Oh, the fake audience.
They did that with a PlayStation 4... What's the name of that thing? The share...
Oh,
like,
right.
There must be something you can download. It was like a weird Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode.
It was a lot.
Especially because they moved every once in a while to give the appearance that those were actual
people. It freaked
me
out the first time I saw one of them move. I'm like, wait, they're not cardboard? What's happening? I don't like it.
It was really strange. But it was like super soothing at the same time. And again, would absolutely listen to Mark Cerny read me the recipe, like the ingredients label on any box, mm-hmm. like a cereal box or anything like that. And it's weird because like I've fallen asleep listening to John Carmack give keynotes like for Oculus, but I was enraptured by Mark Cerny.
One of the paper people on the left kept touching their face.
Oh.
Which made me nervous the entire... I'm like, stop touching your face, fake person.
Yeah, well, they were too close to each other. They were not social distancing. It was really freaky.
It was disconcerting.
It was really bad signals.
Well, and we've been watching Ugly Delicious on Netflix. And of course, it was all filmed before the virus. And people are like shaking hands. And there's so many people. I'm like, what are you doing?
It was deeply uncomfortable.
You need to move away from one another.
But really, anything that I could do to watch more of Dave Chang.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
Good stuff. So with one of the things that came out, obviously there were the technical specs, but both companies reaffirmed that they are shooting for a holiday 2020 release.
They're going for
it. They're doing it. And I think there was a DFC intelligence report that came out last week where they said, oh, it's likely that one or both consoles will delay until the new year.
Which we discussed on episode zero.
We did. And it's not something that I really expected was going to happen. So my first question for you, Matt, is since they seem to be charging right ahead to holiday 2020, what happens if something disrupts production and one or both decide to delay as we move a little bit further into the year?
Right. It's a very complicated and fluid environment we're in. Obviously, things are changing daily. It's always good and necessary to have a plan. To do everything you can to reach that plan. However, you know, in an environment like this where things are constantly changing, it's always good to have backup plans, B, C, D, and E going down the road, and I'm sure they do. So the affirmation that things are still coming this year is expected, and everyone should take some solace in that, you know, folks are still thinking that they can reach these goals, but perhaps they can't. I think, you know, all the cards are on the table right now. Things could go a lot of different ways. Now, if one or both does delay, it is what it is. Like, there's nothing we can really do about it. From a market perspective, you know, just taking away everything else but the video gaming market, I mean, obviously, this is a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. We're already very late in the PlayStation 4 and Xbox One life cycles. We're seeing the declines on a monthly basis, some pretty big ones last year. And the Switch, you know, it's doing very well, but we're also entering the peak or actually on the, you know, on the downside peak of its performance for its lifetime, right? So,
Yep. You
know, having new generation consoles this year was a big focal point for everybody involved in gaming. But, you know, the world does what it does, and if it doesn't happen, the folks that are most agile and able to adjust their supply chains and production, get everything lined up for a later release, if that's what it has to be, that's what it has to be. And hopefully it doesn't go there, but It is what it is. And, you know, we'll have to see how things like play patterns change, how folks adopt things like subscription services. If there is an extended period where folks are hanging out at home, we have to watch the jobs market. We have to watch the economy. There are so many factors at play that, you know, anyone that says they know what's going to happen is either guessing or lying or both. And so I don't think there's anyone that really knows what's going to happen next as we move forward. But yeah, having the plans in place is great, and everyone working towards the plans is great, and hopefully things work out.
You know, best case scenario here is what, from what Mike and I have been discussing a lot since probably the middle of February, is that we're anticipating from our end the same kind of thing that we saw with the Nintendo Wii. So that's a good segue into our next question. You know, what do you see happening if neither console ends up delaying, but the supply is extremely constrained?
Yeah, that is an option, right? So now the launch year supply of new generation consoles, historically going all the way back to the PS1, they're up and down. They're all over the board. There's no real consistency, and that depends on a lot of factors, but primarily it's how many units can be produced. If we're in a situation where we get, say, a third of what, say, for example, if we were going to get 600,000 units in the US for a particular console, but instead we get 200,000, all of those pressures that we normally see at the beginning of a console generation where units get snapped up, if units are in short supply, you see elevated prices on gray markets, mm-hmm. people are fighting to get a box so they can resell it on eBay for $1,000. I mean, all of those factors would ratchet up a few notches so long as other things like the job market and economy are holding up.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely would not be an ideal situation for the video game fan who just wants a box to play. It would become a really unpleasant situation all around if we do get extremely limited units. And, you know, that's not good for anybody. It's not good for retailers. It's not good for publishers. It's not good
mm-hmm.
for the first party manufacturers, right? So those are the decisions that are going to have to be made. If it's a, hey, we can go out with a unit volume we're comfortable with versus, hey, we're going to get something out the door, there's going to be benefits and drawbacks to that. And doing that calculus of figuring it out, which is the best approach for the brand, might take precedence over just trying to get something out the door.
Gotcha.
That's fair.
I mean, the interesting thing is, again, going back to that DFC intelligence report, was their feeling was that demand is going to be exceptionally high, that constrained supply or a delay will only increase demand. I don't disagree with that.
And under normal economic circumstances, I'd agree that that's probably the case. But just like you were saying, Matt, like there's no way to know what the economy or what the job market is going to look like within a month, let alone within the next six.
Correct. And some of the sentiments we're seeing are that, you know, in a market where 2 months ago you had extremely low unemployment, the gig economy firing on all cylinders, everything's changed
yeah.
since then, especially in certain markets. And no one knows what's coming next over the next few weeks and months. So having any kind of assumption on that is okay, I get it. You want to have an assumption where things get back to normal fairly quickly. Perhaps they don't. And that's, you know, those alternatives are what, where the concern is.
Sure. And, you know, you mentioned that we're starting to see some of that. You know, we've talked about the hardware side now. We're starting to see some impact on the software side. I'm a physical media guy. I prefer to purchase physical media, especially when it comes to the Switch because of storage space concerns. I had a copy of Animal Crossing, and I still do. I haven't canceled it because we have kids. But I have a physical copy of Animal Crossing. They're supposed to be here tomorrow on launch day. Now it's not coming till next week because Amazon is reprioritizing, which is completely understandable. We've also seen, and there was kind of some murmuring about this because Amazon sent out emails to those of us who had pre-ordered physical copies of Final Fantasy VII Remake, which is due out on April 10th. The release date was kind of up in the air. It's not that the release date is up in the air. Now Square Enix has released two statements. One was, hey, don't worry, we're still releasing on April 10th. And the second one today was, okay, we're still releasing on April 10th, but what we're starting to see now is that physical physical product may be delayed. And now that people have, you know, 3 weeks of lead time before that game comes out, you know, if this sort of thing continues, and I think Square Enix is just the canary in the coal mine, as I said on Twitter, as opposed to a standalone or a unique case. If this pushes people to choose digital instead of waiting days or weeks for physical availability, what might those impacts be?
Well, we've been seeing a digital share shift for some time, since way back in, say, 2012. We've seen that happen. We've also seen a dramatic increase in the number of digital-only releases. So 83% of the video games launched on console and portable platforms last year were launched digital-only. So we've had this big overarching shift for some years now. This is going to potentially accelerate things, obviously. You also have the additional impact of folks spending more time at home and being more socially isolated. Video games are a great way to spend that time. It's also a way to connect with family and friends when you can't hang out with them. So all of these factors will impact. Now, if distribution starts to struggle trying to get products to people's homes as they're emphasizing things like health and or health aids or other household essentials, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to see more people decide to buy digitally. Some genres and some franchises tend to do far better physically than others. There's a collector's aspect to a number of genres and franchises. Mm. And that could get strained, no question about it. I think we're all kind of learning in real time right now and seeing what's happening right now. And like you said, it could be a signal of things to come should things not get better in the near future.
Oof. It's just a giant oof all the way around. Like, all these weird ripple effects, and that's been something we've talked about a lot this week, is just the ripple effects.
Yeah, that's been kind of our theme of a lot of the discussions that we've been having, is watching things, how things, like, ripple out. With the conversation we had with Steph, especially Stephanie Tinsley, is we talked about the ripple effect from the last recession and how it kind of hit the video game industry, you know,
later and not as severely
because for whatever reason, just the conditions were different. And now, you know, with everything being canceled or supply chains are being rerouted and delivery mechanisms have to change and reprioritize, it's hitting us a lot harder.
In terms of financial impact, it seems like unless you're Blue Apron or a supermarket, you're getting hit by this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's other ripple effects too, just from folks, like in the financial crisis era, right? I still go to work every day, and we all were in the building in Santa Monica trying to make sure we could execute plans on these games. And there was no disruption into how we went to work to develop marketing plans or sales plans. Folks are having to learn how to work together again on the fly right now with folks in offices scattered everywhere. The Monday get-together meeting is different now, and people are trying to figure out that you have to mute when you join the conference call or the video chat, right? It's so, like, we're not only adding all these disruptions to the marketplace, we're adding disruption to the supply line and even the production channels, and everyone's learning how to do things differently, and that'll have an impact. And so, yeah, you add impact or ripple on ripple on ripple, like you say, and you know, we have to see where we come out on the other end. And I think no matter what happens, we're going to see fundamental changes in how we work together coming out of this, no matter how long it lasts. I think there's even ways in how we socially interact that are probably going to change. So, yeah, the scale of what's happening is going to take a long time to understand, but it will have implications both in the short term and the longer term.
Which is a great segue to talk about retailers. And I know that, you know, we're not going to do too much speculation, but, you know, I'm the kind of person where I love to look backward, to look at past trends in order to understand or have a better understanding of where we are now and where we could potentially be going. That was part of the way we tended to run a lot of our analysis pieces at Game Daily. So the question that I have for you is about retailers, and based on past information and past patterns, you know, which retailers are best positioned to weather these kinds of this circumstance based on, you know, past patterns?
Well, I think right now distribution networks are critically important, and the ability to come back from setbacks. So for example, I'm sure you've heard in the New York warehouses of Amazon, they have an employee that was, in Queens, and they've had to shut down that facility for a little bit as they clean it. I mean, there's going to be more of that, most likely. Yeah. So those retailers that have distribution systems in place, logistics systems in place that can be the most agile, are probably going to weather this better than others. It's going to take a lot of quick thinking and smart planning and health and safety measures in place to protect people. And those are the folks that are gonna likely come out of this in much better shape. And you know, but again, how long this lasts, how big it spreads, what happens from here are all variables that you really can't control for.
Well, you mentioned health and safety, and we just mentioned Amazon shutting its warehouse temporarily in Queens. You know, we talked on the show yesterday with Brandon Huffman from a legal perspective that GameStop is staying open, that there have been rumors, and I want to emphasize this, that there have been rumors, there have been people who allegedly work for GameStop online at the store level who have said this, that the stores, that the company isn't providing adequate cleaning supplies, that there was even a potential dispute or disagreement between store level and corporate management about keeping demo kiosks on. And then there was the pictures. Like there was some photographic proof of what looked like an email that went out to stores of, hey, tape squares on the ground so people have to stand, like you have to make people stand 6 feet apart and
limit the amount of people.
Yeah, no more than 10 people in the store. But you know, as emails start coming in from large department stores, from I got one from The Art of Shaving, like I mentioned on the show yesterday, where it's like, hey, we're closing all our stores.
Old Navy's a good one.
Old Navy's another one, yeah. And, you know, there are bookstores that are closing. Any place, you know, Starbucks in our town has now completely closed.
Mm-hmm. I think actually all of the cafes in our town have closed.
Yeah, so it's not even like you can come in and get your stuff with a mobile order. You just can't go in. So, you know, when you have stores that aren't closing, is that, I mean, to me that says, and I'm not going to ask you to potentially speculate about somebody's intentions. To me that says like, hey, if we don't stay open, especially in a week where there's two major releases that people have been clamoring for, that's going to do severe damage to our business in a way that it might not have done a decade ago when GameStop was in its height. But one of the things that I've also noticed, and I've done the math on this, and I've used some calculations based on NPD reports. You know, it looks like GameStop is underperforming the average. It looks like potentially Target is doing really well, and if you go into a Target, they've gone really big on Switch. It just seems like we're in a situation now where there are retailers who seem to be very cognizant of the health and safety issues, and there are some who are potentially worried about how this is going to impact them in a more severe way.
So I think, we have to, I think it's important to applaud retailers like a Macy's or a Kohl's or those folks that have decided to close their stores temporarily until things become a little bit more clear. There's obviously challenges when you have two big new releases coming. Like, mm-hmm. I've seen the same reports online that everyone else has. I don't have any real insider knowledge of what's going on there. As a consumer, I would be, speaking for myself, I would be very nervous going into a retail location with a big crowd of folks right now, especially in certain cities. It's really tough. I can see all the issues at play. I'm not comfortable with some of the stuff that's being said out there. I guess I'll leave it at that. It's, you know, it will, if no retailers are open for certain products, it will shift the needle around. It will move shares around. Mm-hmm. There are some business realities tied to that. However, I don't know. In my mind, the public health is a more pressing issue. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
That's fair.
The other thing that kind of popped up, and this is not a new beat in the next gen story, but it is a software conversation. Obviously, we haven't heard from Sony on this issue, but Microsoft has come out and said, hey, we don't anticipate that there will be any Xbox Series X exclusives for at least a year, maybe up to two. Now, that's not to say there won't be first-party exclusives. They'll play across Xbox One.
With smart delivery.
Yep, with the smart delivery thing that they talked about, which is it'll deliver the right version of the software. So if it's optimized for Series X, it'll give you the Series X version. You'll get a better...
I fully explained this on the Engaged Family Gaming podcast a handful of weeks ago.
I am not surprised. It's what's interesting to me is that we're likely to see a different approach from Sony. I don't know, especially because yesterday Microsoft has kind of come out and said, hey, we have a one family approach to software now.
It's an ecosystem.
Yeah, it's an ecosystem approach. They are also like fully on PC with their first party games. And Sony is slowly taking tiptoes into the PC world. Horizon's coming to PC. And I know they're not publishing Death Stranding on PC, but Death Stranding is coming to PC. So that's a former exclusive. How might this conversation between, you know, a PlayStation 5 exclusive that doesn't appear on PlayStation 4 versus an Xbox Series, an Xbox exclusive that appears on Xbox One and Xbox Series X, might that influence the conversation at all when it comes to this holiday when we assume that both consoles are launching until we hear differently?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are very different approaches, like you mentioned, right? Microsoft has been leaning into the ecosystem approach for some time, across both the console and PC, as well as cloud and subscription. They're trying to put together a gaming package where basically your content follows you everywhere you go, and you'll be able to play games whatever, you know, wherever you are, whatever you happen to be doing. Sony has been extremely successful with the PlayStation 4 in doing things a little bit differently. Focus on single-player content, a more traditional console approach. I don't see that changing significantly. Perhaps PlayStation now gets a reboot and they become a little bit more forward in its marketing and promotional efforts. Perhaps, the word's opportunistic, by the way, perhaps they'll become a little bit more opportunistic in porting decisions to the PC platform. But they're going to stick to, I believe they're going to stick to a strategy that got them where they're at, which is exclusives on the PS5 at some point that are going to try to push that hardware as much as it can be pushed. Whereas on the Xbox side, I expect them to try to deliver a great gaming experience regardless of where you're at or what you're playing it on. These are very divergent approaches, right? And what we've seen in this generation is that about one in every three PlayStation 4 or Xbox One owners in the US owns both a PlayStation 4 and an Xbox One. So we've already seen the divergent approaches in this generation lead to pretty high cross-ownership. If we see a next generation that's even more divergent, that cross-ownership rate could actually go up, and it could actually benefit the entire console market, because you not only have folks that are going to pick one or the other, but you're going to have a higher percentage of folks that pick both just because of the options that are available. So that's going to be one of those things where different approaches, an expansion in the way people can play, an expansion in the kinds of services that they can utilize, cloud, like there's going to be more ways to play. And whenever there are more ways to play, you see more engagement and you see more consumer spend. And I think that's what the console market has to look forward to with these more divergent platforms. If everyone's offering the same kind of thing, then we're having the PS2, Xbox Cube era. Hey, you pick one or the other. They're basically all playing the same games, doing the same thing. Who cares?
In it's about aesthetic.
One console had a handle.
In this upcoming generation, you're going to have so many different ways to play, so many different approaches, so much in terms of different content. It's actually a really exciting time to think about the ways people are doing things differently.
So along those lines, and this is a corollary question I didn't anticipate asking, but has actually popped up, also about software, also about approaches. Microsoft is going to a single SKU approach for its games that are going to appear on Xbox Series X and Xbox One. So you buy one, you get it on both platforms. It's kind of a PC system, right? What is the likelihood that third-party publishers will embrace that as opposed to what we've seen over the last couple generations, which is the HD remaster or the re-release or whatever it ends up being?
Right, you're already seeing a bunch of that in the market right now. There's a bunch of Xbox One 360 back compat games that have physical SKUs in market that are basically branded Xbox One / Xbox 360, like it's dual branding on the package. So it's literally just like an expansion of that idea. Now for third parties, they've made it optional for the download situation and upgrade or however you want to call it for the next generation system. So we'll have to see how many publishers take advantage of that. I imagine quite a few will. We'll have to see. When it comes to remasters or the traditional approach, like that's somewhat fallen off a bit in recent years, especially for just the prior gen. Like we've had things like the Crash Bandicoot and Spyro Reignited series come. But, you know, we're seeing more remakes than remasters at this point. Like the RE, the Resident Evil 2, Resident Evil 3 type of thing.
And Final Fantasy VII, for that matter.
Right, and those have been extremely successful. We're not just talking like, you know, a remaster will get you some sales, but, you know, those are afterthoughts, whereas a remake can be a top 5 selling game of the month and can stay in the top 20 for a while. Like, so your bang for your buck could actually be a lot higher with a remake, although it does involve some additional investment. The return is so much better.
Yeah.
Whereas a remaster will only get you a little bit for a while. So, I mean, I think those kind of decisions are going to drive it. Rather than just trying to get things out the door that are cheap, quick, because the cheap and quick in an environment where service-based games like a Fortnite or a Minecraft or a Grand Theft Auto 5 are taking so much of people's time, like a remaster, it was, say, 5 or 10 years ago. Like, there's just not enough there to keep people engaged. Whereas a remake, you can really, you know, get some conversation going, get some momentum, and have a really good extended sales period.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I mean, the only exceptions that I've seen to that has been for the Switch. So some re-releases for, say, Ni No Kuni, Wrath of the White Witch on Switch has been really great. I know that that's a remaster over on the PlayStation 4, but it's just a re-release for that was the PlayStation 3 version over on a new console. Other things that came to mind for me are Chocobo Mystery Dungeon and things like that. But it's like Nintendo just kind of has its own rules and just plays its own game most of the time. It doesn't adhere to any particular strategy. It's just like, no, this is going to work for us. It always does. And lo and behold, it always does.
Yeah, and trying to predict what Nintendo is going to do at any particular time is a bit of a fool's errand. Like,
it is.
Like, what's Nintendo going to do for next gen? Like, come on, man. Like, I don't know. Like, whatever they do, it's either going to be a huge hit or a huge miss.
You're,
I don't know.
You're going to wear the console. It's just it's going to be a shirt you put on. You are the console. You are Mario.
Like, we are not having this conversation. Sure. We are not doing this right now. If we want to have, like, a prediction conversation about Nintendo's nonsense in later episodes, we totally can. We can make it, like, a battle royale. But we are not doing that today. But we do have one more question for you before we get going, Matt. This is coming from Pauletto G over on Twitter. And he's been following the industry for the better part of 15 years and doesn't necessarily understand how profits are split when a game gets purchased by a consumer. You know, for example, how much of the $60 retail price tag would a person, like, how much of that money would go to the developer, the publisher, the retailer, and how does it differ from being sold, say, on one of the digital marketplaces versus physical? It's a big question, but it's a really important one. And industry enthusiasts especially are like, but dude, how does money work in this industry?
So I spent a lot of years working on these kinds of deals, doing demand planning, trying to understand the P&Ls and how money flows across the parties. And the real answer is it depends. It is inconsistent. You'll see some charts out there in the internet and some articles written that break it down in a pie and with very specific percentages going here and there. And that's just never the way it really is. There's a lot of factors that determine that. If a studio is owned by the publisher versus a studio that is contracted. So for example, with a contracted agreement, the percentages, where the money comes from, is it off of gross rev or is it off of operating income? Like where the percentage even comes from is negotiable. What allocations are made for things like marketing spending are all negotiable. Those things will vary from point to point. The only things that tend to be more firm are the royalty rates or the percentage cut, or the royalty rates, meaning the cost that is paid to the first party console manufacturer for the ability to publish the game on that platform. That is generally a flat fee depending on the retail price of the game at launch. On the digital platforms, it's a flat percentage that's paid off of revenue, off the price the consumer paid. Everything after that is pretty fluid and negotiable. Some developers can even do things like determine a flat fee they'll be paid for their work on a particular title. Other developers will get a percentage off of one or other metric. So there really is no one answer here. These agreements run the gamut and all over the board, and some developers are a heck of a lot better at negotiating these deals than others. But every single metric in an agreement can be negotiated. And I would say developers, you should negotiate harder generally. But that's a whole other discussion for another day. But yes. for the answers, how developers make money? Developers make money based on what they negotiate and how they want to make the money in the negotiation agreement with a publisher or with a first party. Independent developers are an entirely different world with an entirely different rule set, some of which I don't even understand. So I'll leave that for those folks to chat about.
Great. Just to answer one of Poletto's questions about online, one of the big conversation when Epic kind of came out and said, hey, we're changing the way revenue splits work, is that Steam, Xbox Live, PlayStation Network, Nintendo eShop, we're all pretty consistent at 30%. Same thing with Apple, same thing with Google.
And those haven't shifted.
And those haven't shifted with the exception of Steam going to its tiered structure based on amount of sales. And then, yeah, Epic came in and said, all right, we're doing 88-12. 88 for whomever's selling the game and 12% for us. And then Discord was, I think, 90-10 when they still had a 90-10. Store, but that was that arrived and then it walked out the door. It was like Grandpa Simpson came in, took its hat off, put its hat back on, and walked right back out the door.
It's fair,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, one of the things that one of the misconceptions out there is that people say, well, hey, a digital game should be cheaper because you don't have to pay for the packaging of the game, you don't have to print the disc. But like you say, that percentage cut off the top, you compare that on the digital side to the royalty rate on physical in addition to the pick, pack, and ship. And you know what? Your digital margins might be a couple percentage points better, but it sure as heck ain't enough to warrant a wholesale reduction in the price of a digital game versus a physical game. There are just a lot of costs on the digital side that basically make it a wash. So like the idea that, you know, publishers are getting over selling a digital game at the same price as a physical game, like I get why people would think that, but in reality, there's a lot more under the hood that makes that a difficult proposition. And still, like, I get that people want, they think it should be because they're not getting a disc. I totally understand that. But unfortunately, it's not quite that straightforward.
Well, next time you come on, we'll talk about decay curves and reserve pricing at retail, and that'll be a fun conversation.
Oh, price protection reserves, let's go! Yeah, let's do it.
Well, buckle up. That's
we
the
are
future.
Such nerds, and I love it.
Deferred revenues, come on, man! Operating income goals, like 15% OIs, let's get it.
Man, we're going to have to crack some beer and have that conversation. That's going to be an after dark conversation,
oh,
I think.
It's so good.
If we can ever meet in person, ever again in the history of the world, we
can do that. Absolutely.
I love it.
Today's Indie Spotlight is Red Team Games, and we have with us Kevin Hovdestat to talk about the sequel to Cards and Castles. Cards and Castles is a collectible card and strategy game. It was released in 2015 by Red Team Games. It's available on Steam now, free to play. Kevin, how is the sequel going to be different? What should players expect?
In the original Cards and Castles, you had a deck-building strategy game that allowed you to place your units on a grid for tactical battles using animated characters. Cards and Castles 2 is hopefully going to be a big step forward. We're moving to a new engine. We're going to have more interesting and more dynamic combat. We're also hoping to ship with a complete free-to-play single-player campaign.
So on the show, we've talked a lot about how the GDC cancellation and E3 cancellation have had a big impact on developers and publishers. Curious, were you planning on attending GDC or E3, pitching the game, showing it off to press?
We didn't have a plan to be present at GDC, but we were actively talking about how to be at E3. Matt, the head of Red Team Games, is actually a game developer at another studio by day. Red Team and Cards and Castles are kind of his evenings and weekends project. But he's relatively local to LA, and being at E3 to talk about Cards and Castles 2, which is a working title, it may end up with a different name, was something that was kind of on the table. And then obviously the whole industry is kind of reeling from the event cancellation, but also what that's doing to the industry as a whole. Interesting games is definitely up. So it's been kind of a mixed bag, and I'm not sure how that's going to play out for us long term.
Kevin, how far along in development is Cards and Castles 2, working title, and what are the things that you need right now in order to move development to that next phase?
So the Cards and Castles sequel, we're actively working on kind of core mechanics right now. It's going to be relatively easy for us to bring over some of the content from the original game into the sequel, but we're going to an all-new engine, so that means a lot of changes to basically everything. We have people working on game design, art, sound, but right now the biggest things holding us back, honestly, are we're actively sourcing additional people to be part of kind of an alpha testing QA team to help us find any potential issues with the game and just get raw feedback on kind of the new mechanics that are going into the sequel. There's also potentially room on the team for us to add some folks working on things like animation or VFX. But on the whole, I mean, we're making progress, but it would be really great to find people who are interested in contributing to playtesting is the big one.
Well, that's great. Before we let you go, just tell us, where can we find you online? Is there a Steam page where we can find you? I know that the second game is kind of early in development, but why don't you tell us where to find Cards and Castles?
The original Cards and Castles is on Steam, iOS, and Android. So if you want to check Cards and Castles out today, you can look up Cards and Castles on Google Play, on iOS, or on Steam. The base game is free to play, so if that interests you, I definitely encourage you to play the original. People have compared it to something like Hero Academy meets Hearthstone, if that is something that sounds exciting to you. The sequel, we don't have anything set up for officially today. Obviously, you are more than welcome to follow us on Twitter at Cards and Castles. There's a active Discord and a community on Reddit. Long term, if you want to hear more about the upcoming sequel or any opportunities to be involved in the sequel, you're welcome to follow myself, Kevin Hovdestad, at Lack of Realism on Twitter. And I'm happy to take any questions if people have them and look forward to hopefully hearing from some folks.
Great. Thank you so much, Kevin. We're looking forward to hearing more about Cards and Castles 2 or whatever it is that you decide to name it.
Thanks to Red Team Games. Really excited to find out more about the sequel to Cards and Castles. If you are an indie developer or a publisher and you would like to be featured in our Indie Spotlight, please reach out. Our DMs are open on Twitter at VirtualEconCast. You can also email us at podcast@fsquared.biz. We have one more show this week, Manda.
Did we actually get through the week? This week has lasted a month.
I know. And this month has lasted a year. And 2020 has, in fact, been a decade long.
Okay, well, that's really upsetting. And I mean, time is a flat circle, I suppose. So time dilation. You know what? I don't have the energy for this. So tomorrow, we're talking to Victoria Tran, who is the communications director at Kit Fox Games. And she's going to be chatting with us about community management and how to keep things afloat in a crisis with your community.
Or how to build a community in times of crisis.
I like that. Yeah. Oh, wait, we're doing that.
Yes.
Oh, go us.
Yes, go us.
All right, well, thank you so much for listening to the Virtual Economy Podcast. This is episode
three.
Right, because we started at zero.
We should never have done that. It's going to confuse us forever.
It was so stupid. It was the worst idea we've ever had. And we've had a lot of stupid ideas in the last 5 years. Anyway, follow us on Twitter at @virtualeconcast. I'm at Amanda Farrow.
And I am at Footerish, F-U-T-T-E-R-I-S-H. Matt, where can people find you online?
If you're on the hell site that is Twitter, I'm at Matt Piscatella, Matt with one T. If you're not on Twitter, thank God. Good for you. I'm also at npd.com. You can find all my blog posts there.
Oh my God!
Can I frame an audio clip?
Like, maybe.
I want to do
that. We'll print out Matt's face and then we'll just put like that specific frequency underneath it. That's amazing. Perfect. Anyway, you can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on a bunch of different places
we're
now.
We're getting approved.
So we're on Stitcher. We're on
Spotify.
We're on Google. Yep. We're on, where the heck else are we?
There's a couple of others. If you use an app and we're not there,
let us know.
Yeah, there is one. I think Overcast is the one we're not on yet because they pulled from Apple Podcasts and we're still waiting.
Yeah, we're waiting for approval for Apple Podcasts. We probably won't have that until next week or even the week after. So we'll just be patient with Apple. I think they'll like us. We're pretty high quality people. But we'll let you know when we're approved.
Yes. And if you have a question for the show or for one of our guests specifically, please feel free to DM us. Again, the Twitter is @virtualeconcast, or you can email us at podcast@fsquared.biz.
We'll be back tomorrow. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.